Marcus, over to you. Paper two, for those of you in radio land.
Wayne, you forgot to mention that it's our first session, so everybody has to be nice to us.
Yes, it is. These gentlemen are up for the first time, so you have to be nice to them for at least the first little bit here. Marcus?
Thank you. So in this agenda paper, we address the feedback on the draft interpretation uncertainty over income taxes that was published in October 2015. The draft interpretation received broad support from respondents as outlined in paragraph 6 of the agenda paper. Although respondents generally supported the interpretation, some respondents raised concerns regarding particular aspects of the interpretation. The areas of concern are outlined in paragraph 7 of the agenda paper. We will go through these areas one by one, and we'll ask the Interpretations Committee questions for each topic before moving on to the next topic. With this, I hand over to Craig, who will lead you through the first two topics.
Thank you, Marcus. Yeah, good morning. The first topic we discuss in our paper is the interaction with the proposed revised conceptual framework. One respondent noted that the use of probable may be outdated when the updated conceptual framework is released. However, in the conceptual framework exposure draft, the board noted that it does not intend to automatically change existing standards as a result of the new framework. Therefore, there are no current plans to change IS-12, which includes a probable threshold or probable recognition threshold, and therefore we consider it appropriate to use this in the interpretation. Question 1 on page 4 of the paper asks whether the committee agrees with the staff recommendation to continue to refer to the requirements of IS-12 rather than the proposed conceptual framework. So with this, I'll hand it over to the committee to discuss the first question.
Any comments, reactions? Okay, well, Martin.
If no one else is coming out. Well, I would fully agree with the staff recommendation if I would have not read agenda paper number 10. And agenda paper number 10 is more or less what the board plans to do on income tax. And it says on page number 6 that the fundamental review of the standard is not required. Narrow scope amendments were not worth pursuing, probably some educational material. On the agenda for today, I see a second topic related to IS-12 on income tax. And if I remind correctly, also in the near past, we discussed several times topics on income tax. So one could criticize that specifically. I mean, and that's another point. I'm absolutely clear that IS-12 is on income tax and not on other taxes. And here, comments where's the difference between an income tax and a value-added tax, and so it might also be challenging for investors to understand the difference in the methodology, because more or less these are artificial brackets, so to say, and overall, if the board is not intending to discuss overall IS-12, one could criticize that, and that's the only thing I want to mention.
Okay. Bruce?
Thanks. I'm in agreement with the staff position. I mean, I think that for us to start preempting the completion of the conceptual framework project and then the potential knock-ons onto IS-12, I mean, I think it's just, to me, a step too far. So I would agree that we want to follow it.
Okay. Let's press on.
So the next topic we discuss in our paper is the scope of the interpretation. A few respondents had concerns about the proposed scope of the draft interpretation. These include the exclusion of interest and penalties and taxes other than income taxes from the scope of the draft interpretation. With respect to the scope, we believe it is clear the interpretation interprets only the requirements in IS-12. IS-12 is silent on interest and penalties, so therefore was the draft interpretation. In both cases, we believe that widening the scope of the interpretation creates a risk of conflict with other IFRS standards. Therefore, we recommend that the scope of the draft interpretation remains unchanged. Question 2 on page 6 of the paper asks, two questions. One, whether the committee agrees not to widen the scope of interpretation beyond income taxes within the scope of IAS 12, and two, whether the committee agrees the interpretation should be silent on interest and penalties.
Bruce?
On the two questions, one, I agree with the first one, not to expand the scope. I was happy with that. But I wasn't necessarily convinced by the one on interest and penalties. The reason I had a concern about it was, if we're going to be consistent with, I mean, if I'm looking at my situation in the company and I'm trying to be consistent with my application of this, I'm saying if I'm taking an assumption or the probability that I'm going to be challenged or whatever, and that may result in interest and penalties, I just feel that we're kind of using the assumption in one place and yet we're staying very silent on the other. I would have addressed both of them just because of the linkage between the assumptions we're making on the one side and the consequence of those assumptions on the other.
Okay, let's do...
Can I ask, how would you have thought about doing that? Do you think that we could have just in the interpretation said it also addresses interest and penalties, or it also addresses interest and penalties directly related to uncertain tax positions, or would you have thought that we need to amend IS 12? Or
no, I think we could have addressed it, yeah, because I mean we're dealing here with the we're dealing here effectively with the impact of uncertain tax positions, and I agree. I wouldn't want to start scoping in. Well, now we're going to start taking on interest and penalties as a wider topic. I think that's what I wouldn't want to do. I'm just saying I think that when we're in a situation where we say there is an uncertain tax position,
is Mike's not on it? Between the mics.
Oh,
sorry.
I'm sorry, Bruce, I didn't, somehow your mic got cut.
There. Okay. Sorry, I was just saying I would have addressed it, as I said, in the interpretation, because I think that once you've kind of taken the assumption that we're dealing with an uncertain tax position, and I mean, this is always my concern, you know, around this interpretation, is we're starting to deal with uncertainty and making assumptions and probabilities, and it's a very judgmental. But I think that once you've taken that decision and you've made assumptions or you've made decisions around the one part, you've got to follow the natural consequences of what that could mean, the impact of that. And to me, the concern is, if I know that I've taken a very aggressive position, I think that there's probably a 90% chance it's going to be challenged. And in measuring and taking into account that challenge, I know there's a 5% penalty on what I've taken. I just feel to address the one side and not the other kind of leaves us halfway there.
Just to clarify, the only reason I asked that, I suppose, there's still a question in my mind that if we were to, you know, do that and say directly address interest and penalties in the interpretation, whether almost indirectly that does kind of change the scope of IS 12, at least for these ones, because I think that maybe all of the requirements aren't necessarily within the interpretation as a standalone, that, for example, if it's probable that the tax authority will accept, you sort of go to 12. So I just wonder whether it could be done in that isolated fashion without actually at least
I guess I haven't been to that step yet. Yeah.
Okay, I've got Young Soo next, then Tony, Carl, Bob, Andrew, and Reinhardt. Excuse me, I'm slow on the uptake this morning.
Can I speak now?
Yes, please.
Actually, I concur with Bruce's opinion. You know, we have to expand the scope to the interest and penalties in this case. I think the interest and penalties are sometimes very material. And also, to me, interest and penalties and income taxes are one body. Interest and penalties originated from the taxes and income taxes. So we cannot separate them out. So if we do not say anything about the interest and penalties, maybe we can allow some kind of different recognition thresholds to the practice. So maybe, you know, in the practice, people can apply the probable threshold to the income taxes, but different thresholds, like the, you know, the virtually certain threshold to the penalties and the interest. That could make a lot of confusions in the practice. So I fully agree with the Bruce's opinion.
Okay, Tony?
I agree with where the staff has got to. My sense is that the key question in connection with interest and penalties are whether they are in fact income taxes or not. Mm. Management has to make that judgment today and will have to make that judgment in the future. If they conclude that particular interest or particular penalties are part of income taxes, then they are covered by this interpretation. If management's concluded that they are not part of income taxes, then you apply whichever standard is relevant. So I think it would be a big step beyond what we're doing to begin addressing the scope of IAS 12 and whether specific interest and penalties are part of or within the scope of IAS 12. So I think that's a big step. And I would support what the staff's done. And if management has concluded that a particular interest charge or a particular penalty is an income tax, then this interpretation will apply to it, because this interpretation applies to uncertain income taxes.
Brian, are you differentiating between it's an income tax versus an interest payment on taxes that should have been paid? Is there a are they the same thing in your mind, or are they different?
No, I think at the moment there is diversity in practice in the way that companies look at interest on overdue taxes or penalties on taxes, and whether they treat the interest or the penalties as income taxes or not. I think addressing that diversity is a long way beyond the scope of this interpretation, because we're getting into this what's in the scope of IAS 12. And so I would be silent on it, but I would say in response to Bruce's challenge that if management has concluded that interest and penalties, or particular interest and penalties, are income taxes, then this interpretation would apply to them.
Carl?
Thanks. Very similar thoughts to John's. And I agree with staff's recommendation on both questions. I would suggest, as recommended in paragraph 16 of the paper, to specifically address the scope out of interest and penalties, I would bring it to the main text of the interpretation. To be very specific and clear that it is a scope out if we have a conclusion about that today.
Okay. Bob, you're next.
I agree with the staff with respect to other taxes that they would be out. With respect to interest and penalties, my preference would be to let's address them. I think they are integral to uncertain taxes. I recognize that IAS 12 is silent on interest and penalties, but in a situation where their tax is certain and the interest and penalties are certain, I don't think there is a practice issue, and so I don't think we need to address that. There is a practice issue when the tax position is uncertain, and I recognize we can leave it up to management to decide whether it's part of the income tax or not. I would prefer to just address it and say it is part of the, it is integral to the income tax, and if they are recognizing a liability for uncertain tax position, that would along with it would come some interest and penalties. I would prefer we deal with the recognition issues.
Andrew?
I think that ultimately I agree with the staff view on both of these. On the scope of taxes, not within the scope of 12, that's a fairly easy one. On the question of interest and penalties, I think it would be useful if we could perhaps look at how we might be helpful to constituents with this. I agree with Tony that in some cases, depending on how the legislation is framed, you might end up taking the view that the interest and penalties forms part of the tax bill. I'm not sure we can be terribly specific in that, because there are very many different forms of legislation, and so it depends very much on how it's framed in the jurisdiction. However, having said that, there are many cases where when you look at the total amount of interest and penalties, it can be at least as much as, if not more, than the underlying tax. And that's what makes me pause a little bit and think what might we be able to do. If you look at the question of whether it's probable or not a tax authority will accept a position, if it's not probable, then it would seem then it's probable that there's going to be tax to pay, because a tax position isn't going to be accepted. And that then took me into a question of whether within the basis for conclusions, there could be some discussion about this particular point, that while it's not covered by the interpretation itself, if it's probable that tax is going to be paid, then that would indicate that the probability threshold in IS 37 would be met. And consequently, if the interest and penalties are not viewed as being part of the tax charge, they would seem to fall within IS 37 and require to be provided. That doesn't affect the interpretation, because I think it does need to be restricted to 12. But I think it would be helpful in pushing people in the right direction when they do the analysis of the two components.
Okay. Reinhardt?
I recognize the issue that we have, that interest and penalties is not part of IS 12, but I think, as many others have said, I find it a bit unsatisfactory to deal with one part of the tax uncertainty when my experience is very similar to what Andrew mentioned, that in many cases, interest and penalties is the majority of the overall or aggregate uncertain position, and in some cases may exceed the actual potential tax to be paid. And so if we don't address interest and penalties within the scope of this interpretation, then management may choose different recognition or measurement thresholds, perhaps, as compared to the underlying uncertainty. And I think that's the risk we have, that there'll be some diversity, continued diversity, that will be perpetuating the diversity that exists. I think, as others have mentioned, there is some diversity as to whether people consider interest and penalties to be part of income taxes, and it may be in part related to the way the tax legislation is written. I think there's also a presentation issue as to whether people view the interest and penalties to be part of interest expense or income taxes. But having said that, I do think my own preference would be that we expand the scope of the interpretation to deal specifically with interest and penalties on the uncertain tax position, because, as I say, it's part and parcel of the same issue.
Okay. I've got Martin and somebody over there in the corner, Jim, and then John. And then, well, Mary, board member privilege first.
I'll wait, actually.
Martin.
Yeah, I believe it's very challenging to address interest and penalties with regard to definition. I mean, it's really depending, and then with Tony, on the tax regime in the specific countries. And overall, more or less, your tax payments in some countries might be the outcome of a negotiation. And then the question, if you have a tax bill of 100 and later on it is reduced to 50, but you have to pay a penalty of 50, more or less, on a piece of paper. So what it is? Is it income tax or not? And I guess really it is a very judgmental thing, and management then have to come to a conclusion. And in material cases, then probably I would, if it is a very material case, I would expect to see and read some disclosures about that.
So you would or would not?
I would not address
would
it.
Not. Okay. Okay. Who did I have next? John and then Jim. Then Murray.
I mean, I think it might be worth exploring the implications for the recognition and measurement. It's in the interpretation on the recognition and measurement of interest and penalties. I suppose I'm in a bit of a similar position to what Andrew said. It seems to leave it out is writing half an interpretation, because interest and penalties are such an integral part of uncertain tax positions. But I'm also conscious of the fact that if you try to scope them in, you're actually crossing into a different standard. But I do think the interpretation would benefit from exploring the link between the recognition and measurement requirements of this interpretation and the need to recognize interest and penalties. Whether you do that in the basis for conclusions or as part of the consensus, I'm probably don't have a real view on. But it seems to leave it out and say it's just scoped out is not satisfactory. But I'm not sure I would scope it in completely and write requirements for it, because I do think you're in a different, you're often in a different, more often than not in a different standard.
Jim?
All right. I think I agree with Tony's view on this, because this interest and penalties are sometimes in certain jurisdictions difficult to identify. And as some of us mentioned, it could be bigger than the income tax itself, but it's very difficult to address. By reading this paper and the wording lays out nicely that we have no other choice to put them in, because we are talking about IAS 12 and IAS 12 only. And obviously, if we could extend this approach to a wider range, that's a different issue. And to this paper, I think I agree with the staff's recommendation. It says so by the logic laid out.
Okay, Mary?
Just a caution and an observation. The observation is, before we place too much emphasis on the scope of IS-12 being silent with respect to interest and penalties in terms of scope, I guess I just want to point out that IS-12 is silent about a lot of things that are not inside the scope of 12, because it approaches the scope by defining what's in it, with one exception, which is government grants. So there are a bazillion things that aren't in the scope of IS-12 and yet are not enumerated, because the scope description is a positive one. Here are the things that are in the standard. And I think that's why judgments have to be made today in terms of whether some interest or penalties are regarded as income taxes that are within the scope or not. The second is, lessons from the board perspective about letting the great be the enemy of the good in terms of scope creep, because if what I'm hearing around the table from people having, in some sense, buyer's remorse about having issued a draft interpretation that decided to be silent about interest and penalties, to decide at this stage to include it, if it's a significant practice issue that wasn't exposed, I think, to make a significant change in the scope of this interpretation at this stage could be quite challenging and could delay completion of something that on its own seems to be something that practice could benefit from. So I just kind of offer those observations, having learned the second lesson painfully, personally.
Point taken. Okay, I started counting this as a binary choice, and then as we got on, I've got some explorers and some maybes. But my count, and I'll have Petrina check me, I have 1, 2, 3, 4 definite ins. I had 1, 2, 3, 4 definite outs, and then I wound up with an explorer and a maybe. Sandy, did you have a reaction on this one?
I had comments similar to what Reinhardt said about presentation and classification. But whether it's in this interpretation or ultimately when an uncertain JAX position is settled, if IS-12 is silent to it, to what the classification is, you're going to have the problem when you actually make a payment, if it's not clear what tax, interest, and penalties. So aren't you always going to have the presentation problem? That's a major question that I had, simply because it would affect things like EBITDA and ratios. So I guess I don't know when you said in and out meaning in keeping them, or I'm sorry, let me say this properly, in the fact of exploring including them?
That's what I meant, yes. People who said we should include interest and penalties in the scope of the interpretation.
I guess maybe you said there was one maybe. I'm probably the second maybe.
Okay.
Can I ask a question? Sorry.
Let's get Mikkel and then Petrina. Mikkel?
Yes, but I am also with the staff then. I think normally I do not like this half-done interpretations, but I think this is logical that we are addressing the taxes, and then the other thing is, so to speak, a logical consequence that you can handle in the company, I think.
Okay. Petrina, you wanted to come in?
I was going to ask a question, but perhaps it's not a question, but just to add on to Mary's thoughts, I suppose as I sit here and think about if we were to do something about this, and I said sort of thinking about the drafting and maybe other questions, I suppose I wonder, given how, you know, how jurisdiction specific and the local tax laws and everything else obviously affect taxes, even what is called potentially interest and penalties, whether if we were to sort of suddenly address it quite explicitly, would we possibly get a new list of questions that said, but what exactly do you mean by interest and penalties? And would, you know, this particular jurisdiction specific interest or whatever, is that directly related to the income tax or is it something else? So I suppose that's just an open question I have.
Could I just add, I think we'd have to re-expose if we opened up the question of interest and penalties. It's an issue we've not put out there for comment. So.
Okay, well, beating this one pretty much dry, but I've got Bonnie, Bertrand, and then I'll ask Gary to come in last. And Bob.
And Wayne, can I come in as well?
Yes, Ton, why don't you come in now since you're on the horn there?
Okay, thank you very much. We are, as a force, rather concerned about interest and penalties, and so we would like to support those who say, okay, we should bring it in scope. If that wouldn't be possible, we would like to recommend the committee two things. First of all, we would like to clarify in the draft or in the BC that IS 1129 might be relevant to disclose the judgments made to estimate the expected value of the penalties of interest, and that is the case if you do not scope in, of course. And further, we were wondering where, if some further work should be done on this issue, if it could be scoped in. Thank you.
Bertrand?
Just to react to what Michael said earlier, I would quite concur with him. I mean, practically, we would deal with interest and penalties on tax uncertainties the same way as the tax uncertainty itself. And to mention also that it can be cash out payments, but it can also be cash in payments when you have a receivable on the tax authority, which happens quite often within our company.
Okay, Bonnie?
I think I was going to propose something similar to what Tone was suggesting, although I'm not keen on adding a whole new issue to the interpretation at this stage of the process. Would it be something that we could address, and maybe Andrew maybe had this suggestion of, along with the uncertainty, the uncertain tax position, there is a need to also address the interest and penalties and leave it at that, and let companies make their own judgments and refer also to, if these things are material, then there needs to be appropriate disclosure around them, which seems like would help people make sure that they go to that next step to think about the interest and penalties, but then refer to existing standards to come to their own conclusions and think about disclosures to how they do that.
I think we have to address it in the basis at a minimum, because we got a bunch of comment letters, some of them quite persuasive on it. So, Bob?
So in the category of exploring, I had thought about Mary's challenge before, and would this delay this project? Is another potential avenue, because I really do think this issue should be addressed. We need to, I think if we don't, there is going to be diversity in practice, and management is going to struggle with what to do. Can we, because I don't think this issue would prevent finalizing, can we finalize this interpretation and add an additional project? Could be eventually, it doesn't have to be interpretation, maybe agenda decision, that addresses the interest and penalties.
That's a thought. Gary?
What Bob just said was my recommendation. I would strongly prefer to address the subject, but at the same time, I think there's a lot of good work in this standard. I think the staff is right with looking to re-exposure if you try to expand it. I think we get this done, that was my recognition that Bob said, is I think this is a big practice issue, and this won't create any more diversity in practice. There's a lot of it there today, and not all interest and penalties are the same. There's one-off transactions that it's unsettled. There's not a big enough body of literature out there which way to go. But then one of the more common ones that's out there where you know it's going to be disallowed, there's just a fundamental disagreement between the taxing authority and the preparer. I think it's a good example would be depreciable lives. The tax authorities may consistently come and say it's 10 years, and the preparer say, no, it's 5 years, and we're just going to declare it 5 years right off. You know they're going to adjust it back to 10. You know you're going to pay, and they've done that for 30 years of audits. So it's hard to argue you probably shouldn't start accruing the interest on that from day one, because that is a big, very common practice issue. And I think that's a recurring one. There's the one-offs and everything in between. So I think it should be addressed, but I think we should finalize this as it is.
Okay. Tony and then Bonnie? Then I'm going to cut it off.
I maybe breaking this into the two pieces. I wouldn't like to agree now that we're going to address interest and penalties. I think the scope of IAS 12 is a... I would take Mary's caution entirely about the scope of IAS 12. So I think if there was a sense that we did want to address it, I would much rather the paper comes back and the staff thinks about whether we should address it and we have that conversation. Because I think the scope of IAS 12 is a difficult thing to address. My sense is, from what I think, particularly what John and Andrew said, is we're probably going to have to say something in the basis, given that we spent 45 minutes talking about it and we got a lot of comment letters.
Yeah.
And maybe we can say something in that context that says, if you've concluded interest and penalties are income taxes, then this interpretation would apply to it. Something like that, that at least gives people a steer about what they're doing without addressing the question that I agree with Mary is a very difficult one, the scope of IAS 12.
Although that wouldn't be based, that what you just recited is not, in my mind, basis. It's part of the interpretation. You don't put guidance in the basis if you can avoid it. So, Bonnie?
My only maybe response to Bob and Gary was, I think if we were to issue the interpretation and then add interest and penalties as a separate question, that would create a lot more confusion in preparers' minds as to, okay, so what am I supposed to do with it? I personally think that a proposal of either taking the next step as Tony suggested and including, if you make the conclusion that it's within IAS 12, then this applies, full stop. That would be my preference. I just think it opens up too many questions if you issue this piece and then say we're going to address the second piece, because I think you're missing.
Bonnie, I think you got the problem today. That, you know, any extra guidance we can slip into here is fine, but I think short of a re-exposure, it's going to be limited compared to what could be. But I don't think it creates any additional problems that don't exist today.
I think this highlights it.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me take this in steps. The first part of question two, which we discussed hardly at all, dealt with whether we should expand it to include all other taxes or some range of other taxes like VAT, value-added tax, and things like that. That's not a new proposal. I remember Laurence, one of our former members, arguing quite passionately that we needed a separate standard on other taxes. I didn't hear any support for expanding the scope to include value-added tax and things like that. On the interest and penalties thing, or the interest and penalties part of the question, I have to say personally that I have a lot of sympathy with the respondents who wrote in and said, look, I get one invoice from the government at the end of the day for 100. And the amount of detail I assume in that invoice varies a lot among jurisdictions. In the United States, you get a very detailed, this is the penalty, this is the interest. Maybe you don't in other situations. But I don't see a consensus for including interest and penalties in the scope of this interpretation. I saw a fair number of people who said, no, let's keep the scope the way it is. So I think then that we do need to bring back as a separate item whether or not we should do something on the question of interest and penalties. That has the virtue of being potentially expandable. So it could address interest and penalties on value-added tax or any interest and penalties paid to a governmental entity, potentially. That may be too broad a scope, but it has that potential. So is there support around the table for, number one, keeping the scope as is? Number two, obviously saying something in the basis about the fact that we got all these comments and this is what we did with them. And number three, asking the staff to bring back at a future meeting an analysis of whether or not we can do something about interest and penalties. Show of hands, all who support that approach? Okay, that's unanimous. Sandy?
This, yeah, I would. I'm raising my hand as well. But when the staff comes back and talks about analysis of interest and taxes, you know, we're presuming in this conversation that it needs to be addressed because it's such a significant item. But if it's such a significant item, it should already be disclosed when payments are made. So I guess as part of the staff bringing it back, I'd like them to look at some disclosures that actually tell people that there have been interest and penalties paid, because the failure to disclose it would indicate that it's not a major issue. So that's just one little tidbit that I would add. My guess is it's probably more significant, but people aren't disclosing it. But there, that should be an indicator of the fact that it's not that important, but it's either that important and they didn't make it, or it's not that important.
Point taken. I had a question for Bob, and then we'll go to Bruce and Sue. Bob, just to satisfy my curiosity, what does US GAAP say on this?
So, Interpretation 48, which dealt with the Nunley codification, dealt with the recognition and measurement of interest and penalties and said they're integral to the tax. If you got it, if you have to pay it, meets the threshold, accrue it. It did not deal with the classification issue.
Okay. Bruce?
Just my one comment on what you said. So you said that we would say something in the basis.
We have to.
Yeah, I've got no problem with that, but the recommendation Tony had made was that we actually gave some guidance, which we'd said maybe we put into the action interpretation, and we're not going to go that far. We're just going
to
leave it on the basis.
I took Tony's point to say that you have to first understand, you got this invoice for the from the government. You have to first understand how much the amount on that invoice is taxes, income taxes. That is reasonably part of the interpretation itself. Then the remainder of the invoice you got from the government is outside of the scope of the interpretation.
Except, sorry, just the, I mean, what I was hearing, and look, I was probing it in, but if we're going to go with it out, I can live with it. But I guess what we asked getting comfort was where we said, was the argument Tony ran that said, if this is, the decision management has to make is whether it's in or out of the it's in or out of the scope of IS-12. If it's in the scope of IS-12, we're covered by this agreement. That to me was the bit that I thought was great guidance for us to actually put into the interpretation.
Oh, and I agreed.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I heard
okay.
A lot of agreement for that. So.
Great.
Okay. Sue.
Wayne, can I say something?
Yes, Tom, excuse me. I forgot about you. But
No problem. Again, I would like to recommend, and I think it's in line with what Sandra said earlier, that the disclosures might be relevant for the judgments made to estimate the expected value of penalties and interest, as long as it is not dealt with in the interpretation. So I would like to ask the committee to include such disclosures or reference to paragraph 129 from IS 1 in the interpretation.
Point taken. Sue?
Just on the disclosure point, I certainly agree that there's likely to be cases where it's material and we'd want there to be disclosures, but the board's busy at the moment trying to get rid of lists of disclosure requirements and to encourage people to think about communication and disclosure principles. So when the staff brings the analysis back, could I just encourage us to look at what's already required by our literature in IAS 1 and also in 12, etc., and to see what would already sort of encourage or facilitate those types of disclosures before we start thinking about what we might craft specifically as well?
Well, can I make a clarify my point? My point isn't so much about crafting or articulating additional disclosures that are necessary. My point is that if this is such a big issue that we need to include it or discuss it, then the financial statements of companies when they actually pay it should already articulate what are the interest and penalties. If they're not doing it, then it's not a big issue, or they just aren't doing it and they should. So my point is that to analyze the issue further, go to the financial statements, get the analytical content that would articulate what in fact people are paying, and then substantiate whether this is in fact a significant issue. That my point is not so much about disclosures, but about looking at what's already disclosed when payments are made and using that analytical content as a basis for whether you take the decision, the discussion further.
Point taken, Sandy. Okay, this was the, I think, the most significant part of the comment letters, so I'm not surprised we've taken the amount of time we have. But shall we press on?
Yes, this brings us to the consensus section of the interpretation. So the first two topics we identified in the consensus section are about the examination by a taxation authority, and that's why we group those two topics together and ask the question at the end. As regards the right to re-examine, the draft interpretation proposed that an entity should assume a taxation authority will examine or re-examine the amounts reported to it if it has the right to do so. In examining the amounts, the taxation authority will have full knowledge of the relevant information. Respondents asked about the period of time for which an entity would have to uphold this assumption, especially if there is no statute of limitations. Some suggested removing the assumption of examination and replacing it with an assessment of how probable it is that examination will occur. Our analysis of this issue is set out in paragraphs 25 to 28 of the paper. We propose to retain the assumption of examination as it is in line with the requirements of IS 12 and was largely supported by respondents. As regards the period of how long the assumption should be upheld, we acknowledge the difficulties for jurisdictions without a statute of limitations. However, we do not propose any changes in this respect, as the proposed treatment received wide support from respondents, and we have only come across very few jurisdictions that do not have a statute of limitations. In those jurisdictions, there is likely to be a point after which it becomes increasingly probable that the taxation authority would accept the tax treatment simply because so much time has elapsed. As regards the results of the examination by a taxation authority, the draft interpretation said that those results are new facts and circumstances that might affect an entity's conclusions about uncertain tax treatments. However, implicit acceptance would be treated differently from explicit acceptance. Some respondents struggled with the concept of implicit acceptance. One respondent said it would be difficult to find objective evidence of implicit acceptance, while others struggled with the differentiation between explicit and implicit acceptance. We have analyzed this issue in paragraphs 32 to 34 of the paper. We agree with respondents that the application guidance on results of the examination by a taxation authority can be improved. We therefore recommend changing the structure of this application guidance to focus more generally on changes in facts and circumstances that can trigger a reassessment of judgments and estimates. We propose that this new structure excludes any specific discussion of implicit acceptance by a taxation authority. Instead, we suggest restructuring the existing examples in the draft interpretation as examples of events and factors that an entity might consider as a change in facts and circumstances that triggers reassessment. In question 3 on page 11 of the paper, we ask, does the Interpretations Committee agree to retain the requirement to assume examination or re-examination by the taxation authority as long as it has the right to do so? And does the Interpretations Committee agree to change the structure of the application guidance to focus more generally on changes in facts and circumstances and exclude any specific discussion of implicit acceptance? With this, I turn over to the committee to discuss.
Comments? Let's break it into two pieces. The first part of the question is the requirement that one assume that they will have, that the taxation authority will examine if it has the right to do so, and that it will do so with full information. I think that was fairly broadly supported in the comment letters. Bruce?
Thanks. I accept that this was broadly supported, but I mean, obviously, I mean, three of the four example countries you've cited are ones I work in, so I mean, I understand the issue these guys are facing. It's very challenging that I mean, we're just not telling these people what to do. I mean, there's a known issue. We've accepted there's an issue. We've identified a hole in the standard, and we're saying, well, okay, we're not going to accept it. I guess the only other comment I'd have fun, I mean, if there's broader support, I'd like to hear it, but I've got a feeling I'm not going to get any support on that. The only comment I would have is I think you've got to understand we're living in a different tax world at the moment, and that is that we've seen huge pressure on companies. We're seeing governments relook at their tax situations, and it would not surprise me if more governments were not considering removing the statute limitations, given that where we are at the moment with tax structuring and the way things are going. I just think we're leaving a very, very big hole in the standard that, you know, I always like to say if this was a problem in France or Germany, I'm sure we would have it on the agenda again, but I had to point that out.
Andrew?
Contrary to Bruce's expectation, I wouldn't, in fact, support him on this. I think that it would be quite helpful for us to include something for jurisdictions where there's no statute of limitations and restrict it specifically to those jurisdictions so that it can't be applied by analogy. I think also there you could read this to say that there's a little bit of an inconsistency, because we're saying that we would assume the tax authority that has the right to do so will re-examine and will have full information, whereas in another part we say, well, at some point it will become remote that they're going to do that, so we don't have to worry. So what I would perhaps suggest is that maybe we could think about, for those jurisdictions where there isn't a statute of limitations, that the reporting entity should give consideration to whether the period of time that has elapsed means that the potential for challenge by the tax authority is remote, and have it absolutely ring-fenced to where there's no statute of limitations.
Just a question, though. Even in a jurisdiction where there is a statute of limitations, my understanding was that if you initiate an examination, if you send a letter to the company, that stops the statute from running. So all you got to do, if you're the taxing authority and you're worried about tax structuring, all you got to do is send a letter. Of course, that also clues the company in that they need to think about it, whereas they might not otherwise. But I wonder if it is, in fact, that major an issue, Andrew.
Well, I think that the degree of sophistication of tax authorities may vary, and I'm not sure, in response to your point, it's a very valid point. I'm not sure that I would want to place reliance on the tax authority being clever enough to send a letter.
Okay, point taken. Reinhard?
I support the staff recommendation, and I would be very cautious about trying to deal with instances where there is no statute of limitations. And because I think if we were to address that and say, you know, in those limited circumstances, here's an exception to the rule, I think we would be undermining the general principle that we have, which is that the tax authorities, the assumption is, will examine and have full re-examine and have full knowledge. And so I would prefer to keep that as a principle, be silent on those limited circumstances, and you know, management will have to look at things like changes in facts and circumstances or other things in those situations where there's no statute of limitations to decide what to do.
John?
Well, I'm not going to disappoint Bruce. I'm going to disagree with him. I support the staff recommendation. I mean, I think to create some form of carve-out and special rule for where there's no statute of limitations is going to open up a can of worms, because once you send a note, the statute of limitations can actually disappear in certain instances. Fraud, for example, it can disappear if there's evidence. So I think it's just too problematic. I do think, though, that the level of uncertainty is a function of time. I mean, as time goes by, the level of uncertainty in the tax position, I think, so there is a relationship between uncertainty and time, and it might be helpful to, you know, without providing guidance about when uncertainty becomes so small, I think it would be useful to try to reference that somewhere in the interpretation.
Tony?
Very similar to Reinhardt and John, I think we have a principle that underpins pretty much the entire interpretation, and I wouldn't want to create an exception. And I think I think it would just be fraught with danger to create an exception. So my understanding, for example, in the United States is if you haven't filed in a state, the statute doesn't begin. So there are just so many circumstances in which it will be difficult. I would be very uncomfortable with creating an exception. My sense is that we should maybe, when we come back to talk about the second question, think about the framework that we're going to give people to assess changes in circumstances, and whether there is something that we can just say something within there, as John suggests, that give people a way of thinking about something. And at what point does it become remote that it's going to be reassessed or whatever, but whether there is something we can build into what we're talking about with the second question.
Gary?
Just one comment on how long statutes last. In my experience comes from half a dozen countries. They actually last a lot longer than you think. Let's say the statute is 5 years. Tony's right, it usually is the date you file, not the fiscal year. But assuming there's an audit and then you have a refiling because of audit adjustments, that statute starts again, you know, and there's other things that tend to keep older periods open. I think the tax authorities always go back on basis, and that could be decades if they need be. And if there's an assertion of fraud or something, that also blows right through, you know, statute of limitations. And so I think the practical thing for at least multinationals is statute of limitations run a lot longer than, say, the 5 years in the statute, because the constant refiling and amending of returns.
Okay. Let's go through the formality of a show of hands. I will label view A the Bruce view. Bruce / Andrew view, that we should introduce something. View B, the view taken by several others, that we should not. Let's try and make it binary. Those who would support Bruce's approach of adding some discussion about. Okay.
Well, you know, we've been friends for a long time. Yeah.
The consensus is no. So let's go to question two, which is probably the more difficult one, or the second part of question three, which goes to the application guidance. Do you want to describe again for us, Martin, in a little more detail what you have proposed to do?
Yes, sure. We recommend changing the structure of the application guidance to focus more generally on changes in facts and circumstances that can trigger a reassessment of judgments and estimates. And this new structure would exclude any discussion of implicit acceptance. So we would take the existing examples in the application guidance, but would structure them differently by saying those are examples of events and factors that an entity might consider as a change in facts and circumstances that then triggers reassessment.
And I'll just highlight this. It's sort of spelled out in paragraphs 33 and 34 in the paper. And I think one important thing for us as well is just in 33, we sort of refer to that it clearly, you know, we're saying it would be a judgmental assessment, but I think you'd look at it particularly in the context of the relevant particular tax laws in your jurisdiction to try and work out, you know, what are the events that you think might trigger that reassessment versus not.
Okay, we don't have a specific wording suggestion though yet.
No, okay. But it would be based on what, 33
would be based on 33 and 34, but certainly the committee's guidance on how to approach this will be useful, depending of course on whether you agree to it. Comments? Reinhardt?
I would support the staff recommendation. I think having a framework that focuses on changes in facts and circumstances and illustrating what types of facts and circumstances might trigger reassessment through the examples, I think would be helpful. I understand why people struggled with the difference between implicit and explicit acceptance. I struggled also a little bit when I looked at the wording of the interpretation. So, as I said, I would support the direction.
Bonnie?
I also would agree with the staff's proposal, as long as the wording is very clear that it's not an all-inclusive list and it's very, very clearly laid out as these are examples only, and it's not used in a more prescriptive way than what is intended.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I support restructuring the paragraphs, but I do think there's a sort of confusion still between whether you need a change in facts and circumstances to re-estimate the uncertain tax provision or whether it's just a change in estimate under IS-8. In other words, something has occurred which causes you to change your estimate. And I think the question of whether there has to be some event which triggers you to make that reassessment, I think, is still unclear in the interpretation. I don't like the language of change of facts and circumstances. I prefer the language in ISA around change in estimates, because I think that's the process you would go through under the interpretation each year. But examples of the types of things which would, you know, result in a change in estimate, I think, is helpful in the standard. I also agree that the implicit-explicit acceptance is confusing and not in the interpretation, and I don't think helps to provide guidance. So I do agree with restructuring, but I do think the notion of it needs to be clearer whether there has to be some change which triggers you to do a reassessment or whether it's just a continual re-estimation process, which you would do for any estimate.
Tony?
Very similar to John's comments, I was one of those that didn't like the implicit-explicit acceptance notion. So I agree that it makes sense to restructure it. Like John, my starting point would be the guidance in IS-8 around changes in estimate and what might lead us on to there being a change in estimate. Given that I didn't like the word acceptance to begin with, I'd probably rather it didn't appear and maybe focus on something like agreement or settlement, so something that implies both parties have come to the same spot. We're not relying on the tax authority not doing anything. And the other thing that I wondered, going back to what we talked about in connection with the statute of limitations, whether there should be something about the passage of time. I think picking up what John said, whether in the end, the passage of time is going to be a change in circumstances, that it's become remote, that it will be challenged or something like that, which would address more broadly the things we were talking about around circumstances where the statute might not expire.
I hear you see the staff all nodding their heads, yes. So
quit while I'm ahead.
Given, yeah. Okay. In any event, so I, number one, pieces. Support around the table for restructuring this, but obviously we're going to have to see the words, and this is going to have to come to another meeting anyway. Right, Petrina? For us to do due process and all those things?
I think due process will come. I think drafting doesn't necessarily come to the table, but due process certainly will come to the table.
My point being that people are not going to be willing to say, I don't dissent, without seeing a draft. So that
I think we'll work on what's the best way.
We'll have to be at another meeting, even though we may not need specifically to discuss this. Okay, let's press on.
Yeah, the next topic in the consensus section is the approach to reflect the effect of uncertainty. A few respondents raised concerns about the probability threshold in the draft interpretation used to determine when to reflect the effects of uncertainty. One respondent suggested using the word expected rather than probable. Other respondents suggested to allow additional methods to reflect uncertainty. We have analyzed those matters in paragraph 39 to 42 of the paper and have concluded that no change to the draft interpretation is necessary. Question 4 on page 13 of the paper asks the committee whether they agree with the recommendation.
Okay, the first part of that question is the probable threshold. Comments or disagreements? Sandy?
No comments or disagreements.
Okay. All right, that'll be taken as written then. And the second question is deals with alternative methods rather than the single probability approach. Bonnie?
I just have a comment, and it's similar to one that I've made in prior meetings, that the cumulative probability approach is not untested. It's used by all U.S. gap filers. So I don't agree with the last sentence in paragraph 42 that including untested methods has the potential to be costly to implement, because all U.S. gap filers have implemented it. They've implemented it successfully, and I don't believe it was significant and costly to implement. So I don't disagree with where the staff has gotten to, but I still reiterate my comment that it's not an untested approach, and I still have a little bit of struggle with a dual gap filer like ourselves could come to a different conclusion for the same tax position because of where this is going, which seems a bit arbitrary to me.
Point taken. It is not untested. I take that point. It is not, however, is it used anyplace else in IFR that I'm aware of? No. So it.
No, I don't disagree with that, but it's clearly used
by
a lot of filers. By a lot of global multinational
filers. Who are also automobile manufacturers. And point taken. All right. I think I see support for the staff position that we stick with a single approach, Bonnie notwithstanding. Sandy, anything to add on that one?
No.
No. Okay. You're on a roll, guys.
Continuing with the consensus section, next topic is consideration of changes in facts and circumstances. The draft interpretation proposed that an entity reassess the judgments and estimates if facts and circumstances change. Respondents asked about the interaction between this requirement and the requirements in IS-8 and IS-10. to better align the requirements of the interpretation and the requirements of IS 8 and IS 10, we propose to include a cross-reference to paragraph 36 and 37 of IS 8 regarding accounting for the effects of changes and clarify that an entity should apply the requirements in IS 10 to determine whether a change in facts and circumstances that occurs after the reporting period is an adjusting or a non-adjusting event. Question 5 on page 15 of the paper asks whether the committee agrees with this recommendation.
Okay, again, two parts to that question, but I think we can deal with them together. Comments or objections, reactions?
I think my mic is still on and I do have a comment. I guess I don't really disagree. I just question why we need to be so explicit. It seems obvious that you would need to apply the other standards if there's a change in estimate or a event subsequent to the balance sheet date.
Yeah, I did find it. I have to agree with Bonnie. When I read the comment letters, this topic came up quite a few times, and I found myself scratching my head about why. And I didn't see a lot of specifics about what would lead someone to ask the question. So I'm seeing, John, you have some enlightenment to shed?
Well, maybe not enlightenment, but I mean, my take on the comment letters was that people were confused between the issue about whether you needed a triggering event to change to be reflected in your measurement or whether you actually just re-estimated based upon new information. And maybe new information is a triggering event. I think the cross-reference to IS 8 is helpful because I think it actually puts it clearly in the context of just any other change, similar to any other change in estimate. But I think that, again, I think there's confusion. It's appeared to me that from the comment letters I looked at, that some people felt, well, the change in facts and circumstances, you only change your uncertain tax position when you have a change in facts and circumstances. So the question is it a, you know, Is it a triggering event which makes that change, or is it just a re-estimation process?
So this would be the same point you made.
Yeah.
Tony, and then we'll get there.
I agree with John. I think the reason people were confused and why they commented about IS 10 is the reference in the exposure draft to recognizing the change in the period of the change. And I think some people looked at that and said, hey, is that telling me to override IS 10? And not consider whether or not the new information affected circumstances that existed at the balance sheet date. Now, it might be that people come at it have been familiar with US GAAP guidance, which overrides the usual subsequent events guidance for income tax uncertainties. But lots of people, that certainly in my shop, looked at it and said, hang on, is that telling us to override IS 10? So I wouldn't necessarily say we need to refer specifically to IS 10, but we at least, I think, need to reconsider the words and make sure that there's no implication that you would ignore IS 10.
Mary?
something that's struck me in the discussions, partly of this point, is it might be helpful to start maybe even earlier in the interpretation with an observation or characterization of these uncertainties, that when the probability of acceptance is less than 50%, sorry, there's a more elegant way of phrasing that I don't have at the moment, that the uncertainty is an estimate that has to be updated at each reporting date. And I think if you just say that, that addresses the question of whether or not you need triggers to update that. Triggers may be helpful reminders of things that might prompt updating, but it puts it clearly in the estimate rather than just a cross-reference to ISA. Because if you say it's an estimate that needs to be updated, that doesn't preclude the fact that in some cases people might have made an error that they have to correct. It doesn't override or conflict with IS 10 in any way.
Yep. Okay. With those clarifications, let's keep going.
The final topic of the consensus section pertains to disclosure. Some respondents propose to remove the disclosure references within the interpretation to clarify that the interpretation proposes no changes to disclosures. They were particularly concerned that the reference to IS 37 has the potential to create confusion about which standard an entity applies. We agree with those respondents and propose to remove the reference to IS 37. However, we propose to retain the reference to the relevant disclosure requirements of IS 1 and IS 12. To emphasize that the interpretation does not change any existing disclosure requirements or propose any additional requirements, we propose moving the disclosure paragraphs from the consensus section to the application guidance. Question 6 on page 17 of the paper asks, does the committee agree to retain the references to IS 1 and IS 12 but remove the reference to IS 37? And does the committee agree to move the disclosure paragraphs to the application guidance?
I'm seeing heads nod around the table. Sandy, this is your favorite area.
You mean the fact that we debate these issues and then no one ever sees them in the financial statement, that item?
No, disclosure generally.
I know. So I can't recall, is the application guidance authoritative?
Yes,
it is considered an integral part of the interpretation.
Okay, I just wanted to confirm that. You know, it's not my favorite thing, but okay.
All right. Again, then we take that as agreement and let's press on.
Wayne?
Yes, Don, I'm sorry.
As enforcers, we were wondering whether this move of the disclosure references will be well understood by the preparers. By moving them, it might create the impression that disclosures are less relevant. So we were in favor of retaining the references to the disclosures in the body and not to move it to the application guidance. And we were also wondering, is this consistent with what was done in earlier interpretations? Because I agree there is no new disclosure requirement, but a lot of times the committee makes reference to disclosure requirements without creating new requirements. We are not sure that the way this is treated is now consistent with what happened in the past. So for those reasons, we believe it will be better to retain them in the body.
Well, that's a good point. How have we, do we know how we've done it in previous interpretations? Yeah, well, obviously we can't do that search now, but we ought to be consistent stylistically.
Well, maybe it's something we can pick up and drafting. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, we'll look at it in drafting. But stylistically, if we have consistently put them in one place or another, we ought to follow it. My fear is that we probably haven't been consistent, and we're going to find it 50-50 or something, but we'll see. We'll follow up on that. Ton, excellent point.
Thank you.
Transition then.
So the next section we discuss in our paper is transition. In the draft interpretation, the committee proposed two transition methods, retrospective application applying IS 8 or a cumulative catch-up approach. The majority of respondents supported including both options. A small number of respondents suggested either permitting only retrospective application or only the cumulative catch-up approach. Given the potential difficulties in applying the interpretation without using hindsight, and the wide support for the proposals, we do not propose amending the transition requirements. In addition, one respondent noted that the requirement in the draft interpretation for repairers to disclose which transition method they applied is already required by IS 8. We agree with this respondent and therefore propose to remove this disclosure requirement. Question 7 on page 19 of the paper includes questions for the committee. Over to discuss.
Comments on question 7? Okay.
This is Sandy.
Yes, Sandy.
I guess I'll reiterate that we as a rule don't like either or, because you know, it affects comparability, it affects trend analysis. I believe that you just said, I guess I would retain the requirement to disclose which method and make it clear that's important, and not leave it to someplace, to another piece of literature, because we do think it's important. I guess those are really my two points. We're not fans of either or. And I'd like to reiterate that it should be stated which approach is used here.
Point taken. We're going to deal with some of that drafting around disclosures anyway. We might as well put this one there too.
Yeah, just one comment I'll make on that, Sandy, if it's helpful, is that the risk we see if we put something different in here, so in this interpretation alone, we say disclose explicitly the accounting policy when we think it's already covered by IS8, it runs the risk then people think that everywhere else that there's an accounting policy choice that it doesn't explicitly say disclose it. You know, because IS8 covers it, it runs the risk that then people think they don't have to provide the ISA disclosure. So
I don't think that's what Sandy was saying. I think she was just emphasizing that there is a requirement in IAS8, and we're already pointing people's attention to those existing disclosure requirements.
Okay. Yeah.
And so let's just add this
possibly
to the list.
Point as well.
Okay. Ones that have a big arrow next to them pointing. Okay. Yes, Bertrand.
Just
a moment while I get my screen up here.
Just to make sure I understand everything on that. In IS8, you don't have any reference to cumulative catch-up methods. So if you do not explicitly require somebody to disclose on that, on the choice of methods, and making it implicit by reference to IS8, IS8 only states a full retrospective application. And if you think of IFRS 15 or 16, whereby this choice of transition requirements was made, I think there is, as long as I remember, there is a reference to effectively disclose on which method you are. So if there is a choice with a method that is not contained in IS8, I would prefer asking effectively the constituents to and the preparers to effectively disclose the choice method they have made.
Okay, we'll take that on. We will take that on board and look it through, work it through in the drafting. John?
Yeah, similar comment. I mean, I agree with the recommendation that they should retain the choice of transition method. I also agree that we shouldn't be including disclosure requirements in the interpretation, which already exists in the standards. I think the interpretation should have, if there are specific disclosures we want in the interpretation, they should be in there. But I think every interpretation shouldn't have to refer to the other places in the standards where there's disclosure requirements covering that issue. I don't think that's a good protocol.
Okay. All right, gentlemen. First time adopters?
Yeah. So, first time adopters, the draft interpretation did not address transition requirements for first time adopters. As such, they would be required to apply the requirements of the draft interpretation retrospectively in accordance with IFRS 1. A number of respondents noted that first time adopters of IFRS standards are likely to face the same potential hindsight problems as existing preparers. We consider this possible if the date of transition to IFRS standards for preparer is before the publication of this interpretation. Therefore, we recommend that a short-term exemption is permitted for first-time adopters with a transition date to IFRS standards before the publication of the interpretation, allowing them to apply the cumulative catch-up approach as proposed in paragraph B2A of the draft interpretation. Question 8 on page 21 asks whether the committee agrees with the staff recommendation to provide a short-term transition relief for first-time adopters.
I don't see anybody jumping in on this one. Andrew?
I agree with the staff recommendation that the only point I would make is perhaps there might also be some consideration around the effective date of the interpretation and how this then links into dates of transition. So just to pick up that point as well.
Point taken.
And just to let you know, we will bring back obviously a question to you about when the effective date should be to a future meeting.
Business combination.
Yeah, the draft interpretation does not specifically discuss whether the requirements would be applicable in situations in which an entity has acquired uncertain tax treatments as part of a business combination. A few respondents asked for clarity in this respect. We have analyzed this issue in paragraph 77 to 80 and concluded that it is beyond the scope of the interpretation to address the accounting for current taxes acquired or assumed as part of a business combination. We therefore propose not to address business combinations as part of the interpretation. And question 9 on page 23 of the paper asks whether the committee agrees with this staff recommendation.
Going once, going twice. So.
Perfect. Last but not least, we listed all remaining issues from the comment letters and our response to those issues in Appendix A to the agenda paper. We're not going through those, but generally asking the question if the committee agrees with the staff proposals outlined in Appendix A to this paper.
Bonnie?
I did have one question on topic number 6, and I did not go back to look at the comment letter, but I was curious if the issue was whether or not you could apply both approaches to one individual uncertainty, or if that was the question. If so, I'm not sure. I think we just need to clarify that one approach would be applied to one position, not to both approach to one position. So I wasn't sure if the response or the staff proposal really got to that question, because I think that's the clarification we just need to make sure is explicitly clear in the okay. In the interpretation.
Point taken. John?
Just in relation to number 7 on unit of account, I mean, I think the amendments that are proposed to paragraph 12 are sort of helpful because they clearly put paragraph 11 as the principle. I'm still not sure that what's written in paragraph 12 actually is an application of the principle, because it seems to me that what's in paragraph 11 talks about the unit of account being determined based upon how you expect the matter to be resolved with the tax authorities, and paragraph 12 talks about the way you actually, it says the entity prepares and supports the treatments. I don't necessarily see the connection between how the entity prepares and supports its tax treatments with how the issues are going to be resolved by the entity. So, but I do agree that it's helpful because paragraph 12 is now sort of is a application of paragraph 11. But it might be worth looking at whether it really is an application of the paragraph 11 principle.
Okay. Point taken. Don, did you have any of these you wanted to pick up on, and then I'll go to Sandy?
Yes, Wayne. I had a question about topic number 20, and more specific about the response from the staff. It's about the question whether best estimate would be a better term instead of better prediction. I can agree with the response. However, in the last part of the sentence, it says, the best estimate, which could be misinterpreted as the most likely outcome. And then I was wondering, that is inconsistent with what is an IS 37, so I was a little bit surprised about that last part of the staff proposal, and I would propose to drop it.
So I'm not quite clear on what you're proposing that we should do.
Now, what they say in the last sentence, we think that better prediction is more neutral and objective. That's fine, but then the best estimate. That's fine. Then, which could be misinterpreted as the most likely outcome. the most likely outcome is not always the best estimate when you read IS 37. So I was a little bit surprised at this inconsistency with what the standard says is there. So I would propose to drop the last part, which starts with which could be misinterpreted as the most likely outcome.
Okay, I don't know that we intended to incorporate that in the drafting in any event, so, but your point's taken. I do think that in practice, and this is a persistent problem, there is a body of people out there who believe best estimate is most likely, that the two are synonymous with one another. And I'm afraid some of our loose language sometimes leads them to that too, so. But your point's taken.
Thank you.
Sandy, anything?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. This is an excellent piece of work, gang. Fine job. Although I hope you've been keeping track of all the drafting suggestions.
We have.
We have quite a few. So we will see you back. Next meeting? Meeting after that? Katrina?
Possibly next meeting.
Possibly next meeting.
With due process. Yeah, we certainly can't promise interest and penalties.